Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, when did historians begin to look seriously at FDR's response to the Holocaust, and what did they discover? The David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies teaches the history and lessons of America's response to the Holocaust through scholarly research, public events, publications, and educational programs. Based on the research of Professor David S. Wyman concerning America's response to Nazism and the Holocaust, the Wyman Institute focuses on the abandonment of Europe's Jews during the Nazi era, the efforts to promote rescue, and the moral and historical lessons of those experiences. Dr. Raphael Medoff is an American professor of Jewish history and the president and founding director of the Wyman Institute.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today. First, could you tell us what the David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies is?
Well, as you know, there are many institutions around the world which study the Holocaust, and there are no shortage of them in the United States either. But the David Wyman Institute is the only one which focuses specifically on how America responded to Nazism and the Holocaust. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we're named after the late David S. Wyman, a Harvard-trained historian who was the author of the definitive study of the American government's response to the Holocaust, the 1984 bestseller, The Abandonment of the Jews. So the Wyman Institute carries on Professor Wyman's legacy and his work by engaging in research on unexplored aspects of how Americans responded to the Nazi genocide.
Something else I think that makes you different from other organizations is that while you base your activities on rigorous scholarly research, your aim is to bridge the gap between the scholarly community and the general public. So before we get into specifics, can you just give us a brief idea of how you do this?
You know, the Holocaust carries with it very important moral lessons. But unfortunately, too often Holocaust research is relegated to the ivory tower. Many scholars who do important work in the field, nonetheless, are not involved, engaged with the public to the extent that they should be. It's our view that the general public has a strong interest in the questions of the Nazi genocide and how the world responded to it, and in America specifically, how the United States responded to it. So we make an active effort to bring our research, our publications, and our other work to the public's attention through programs, through public education, by publishing our work not only in scholarly journals, but also in the popular press, and also by reaching out to the educational community and providing resources that are unique. We use comic books, animation, cartoons, and political cartoons as tools in teaching about how America responded to the Holocaust.
Yeah, I'd like to get into that in more detail. Can you tell us about your collaboration with Disney's educational division?
The Disney educational department enlisted the Wyman Institute some years ago to create a series of animated shorts, that is 8 to 10 minute animated segments about specific instances in which Americans spoke out against the Holocaust. Most of the history of America's response to the Shoah is a history of abandonment and indifference. But there were also a minority of Americans who did speak out, who tried to promote rescue, who tried to alert the America and the world to the truth of what was happening to the Jews in Europe. And the Wyman Institute focuses some of our research and our attention on those brave individuals who did raise their voices at a time when, unfortunately, very few people did.
You've also worked with a number of cartoonists and graphic artists. Can you tell us about your traveling exhibit and program, Cartoonists Against the Holocaust: Art in the Service of Humanity, what it consists of and where it's been shown?
Political cartoons that appeared in American newspapers in the 1930s and 1940s are a very important and until recently undiscovered resource for talking about the events of those years. We created a traveling exhibit of such cartoons in order specifically to bring to audiences around the country, and in particular high schools and middle schools, examples of these remarkable cartoons. They appeared in major American newspapers at the time, and it enables us to look through the eyes of a cartoonist who was there reading the news every day and commenting on it, and seeing through the prism of their perspective what was known about the Nazis' mass murder of the Jews and how America should respond. So the political cartoons provide the public with an interesting way of seeing these events from a different perspective, but they also provide educators, teachers in particular, with a tool for speaking to young people about what is arguably a very complicated and subject to discuss. In 35 of the 50 states in the US, Holocaust and genocide education is required in the schools. And in other states, it's not a matter of law, but it is a matter of policy by boards of education to teach about the Holocaust. So every year, teachers in our schools are faced with a challenge: how to talk about the Holocaust in a way that is somehow relevant or interesting to the average 15-year-old. And this is not an easy task. Teachers typically will assign a book like The Diary of Anne Frank, which is, of course, a very valuable resource. But they also are always looking for new and interesting ways of discussing these subjects aside from the standard texts. Political cartoons offer a visual way to understand the events of that time. So teachers find that our exhibit and our publications using these political cartoons are particularly effective because when a teenager looks at a cartoon image, it tends to have a more long-lasting and stronger impact than just reading an ordinary text about the Holocaust.
So, has this exhibit been shown publicly in venues and just for the general public, or is it something that's pretty much confined to the schools?
It has been used mostly in schools and mostly in the greater New York area, although also sometimes in schools in the Washington, D.C. area also. It's an ongoing project, so we're always looking for new venues where it will be displayed. And we have a book based on the exhibit, which will be published by Dark Horse Books in 2024. It's called Cartoonists Against the Holocaust, and it comes with a teacher's guide with actual classroom lessons so teachers can use these cartoons when they're teaching about the Holocaust.
If any of our listeners are interested in this material, can they get it from your website? Can they contact you that way?
Yes, that's WymanInstitute.org.
You've also collaborated with different artists on graphic novels on themes of Jewish history. Can you give us a couple of examples?
Whistleblowers, Four Who Fought to Expose the Holocaust to America is the latest in a series of educational projects that we have undertaken involving the use of comic book style illustration. A previous book was called We Spoke Out: The Holocaust in Comic Books. It's a book which showcases actual comic book stories which appeared in the 1950s, the 60s, and 70s, which introduced their reading audiences to the Holocaust for the first time. Now, I'm speaking here about mainstream comic books like Batman and Captain America. They were an interesting and unknown to the public, unknown source of a kind of Holocaust education for American teenagers growing up in those years when the Holocaust was not taught in public schools and there were no Holocaust museums that people could visit. So for an American youngster picking up a comic book in the 1960s or 70s, these remarkable stories that are reprinted in the book We Spoke Out were and sometimes their first introduction to the subject of the Holocaust. So it's just another way in which the Wyman Institute tries to use unconventional methods to shine a light on the history of America's response to the Shoah.
Tell us about your online encyclopedia of America's response to the Holocaust.
Well, on WymanInstitute.org, the general public can find a very unique educational resource, the Online Encyclopedia of America's Response to the Holocaust. Here you have, in one place, readable, digestible, encyclopedia-length entries. That is, not overly long. They're not full essays, but they're summaries of the most important aspects, episodes, and individuals who shaped America's response to the Holocaust. So there you can find everything from entries on our political leaders, from President Franklin D. Roosevelt to individual officials in the State Department, the Treasury Department, members of Congress, how each of them responded to news of the Holocaust, as well as lesser known aspects of the American response. For example, prominent figures in Hollywood who were involved in different ways of speaking out against the Nazi atrocities, as well as major events that took place in those years, such as the voyage of the infamous refugee ship, the St. Louis, or the Evian Conference in 1938, at which various countries gathered in France, ostensibly to discuss the Jewish refugee problem, but in fact, having no intention of actually addressing it seriously. So all these interesting events and personalities and chapters in the history of America's response to the Holocaust are there easily accessible to the general public in our online encyclopedia.
Something that I wanted to ask you about is an article that you sent me from the New York Times from 2008 about comic book artists who illustrated a 6-page comic that you wrote to help an artist who had survived Auschwitz by painting portraits of Romani people for Mengele. And she wanted to get her originals back from the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum. Can you tell us about that and whether the comic was published and whether she was ever successful?
The remarkable story of the late Dina Babbitt is one filled with hope and with a great sadness. Dina was a teenage artist in Czechoslovakia who was deported to Auschwitz along with her mother in 1943. She had recently seen the famous animated film Snow White, which had reached Europe in the late 1930s, and she was greatly enamored of the film. So while a prisoner in the youth barracks at Auschwitz, she used smuggled paints to draw a full-color portrait of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs on the wall, on one of the interior walls of the barracks. She was captured by the Gestapo and brought to Dr. Joseph Mengele, not as she feared to be executed as punishment for drawing Snow White, but rather because Mengele had been looking for an artist to assist him, because Mengele had been taking photographs of prisoners upon whom he was conducting hideous experiments, but the quality of the photographic equipment that he had was not up to what he intended, and so he had been trying to find an artist among the prisoners who would paint portraits of some of these captives. And so Dina Babbitt was enlisted for that purpose. Remarkably, she had the audacity to tell Mengele that she would only agree to do these portraits if he would spare her mother. And Mengele agreed. So for as long as Dina was painting, she and her mother were exempt from being taken to the gas chambers with the other Jewish prisoners in Auschwitz in 1943, 1944. So Dina painted very slowly. And in addition to the portraits of the prisoners, she was also used sometimes to paint portraits of some of the Gestapo officers for their own use, their own pleasure. When the camp was liberated by the Allies in 1945, Dina and her mother were still alive. Mengele, as we know, fled to South America. And it had been believed that he had taken at least some of the portraits with him. So she had not expected that any of them survived. But to her great surprise, decades later, she suddenly was contacted by the Auschwitz Museum, which is established on the grounds of the death camp. The Auschwitz Museum is a Polish government-sponsored institution. Officials there informed her that they had come into the possession of 8 portraits of Romani prisoners, and that they were actually signed. Remarkably, she had signed the paintings in 1944, Dina, 1944, and they had spent some time tracking her down. Eventually, they identified her as the artist, and she flew to Poland with a large suitcase, expecting to finally be reunited with the paintings that had literally saved her life. But the museum, the Auschwitz Museum, refused to give them back to her, insisting it was their property. Somebody apparently, some local town person had found the paintings in the rubble of Auschwitz and had sold them to the museum. The museum insisted it was their property. Dina, of course, was heartbroken by this turn of events. She, in the years to follow, enlisted some remarkable public support for the demand that her paintings be returned to her, including the United States Congress, which passed unanimous resolution calling on the Polish government to instruct the museum to return them. But unfortunately, the Polish authorities refused to do that, and the museum stuck to its guns. Well, when I learned about this story, and I learned that Dina, after the war, had become a prominent cartoon animator in Hollywood, she had become the illustrator for such iconic characters as Daffy Duck, Captain Crunch, and others, I turned to the comic and cartooning community with a mass petition urging the museum to return the paintings. Many hundreds of comic book writers, artists, editors, publishers signed our petition. And we undertook also a number of other public programs and educational efforts to draw attention to Dina's struggle and to try to put pressure on the museum to return the paintings. We learned during the course of this effort that the paintings themselves are not actually on display at the Auschwitz Museum, although the museum insisted that they had to retain ownership because the paintings are an educational resource. They want people to see them. In fact, the originals, because of their brittle condition, are not on display. They're kept in storage, and what visitors to the museum actually see are very high-quality reproductions, which look exactly like the original. So there was just no reason not to return them, but they refused to return them. And I'm sad to conclude this telling of the story by sharing with your listeners the fact that a few years ago, Dina contracted cancer, and she passed away without ever seeing her cherished paintings again.
What happened with the 6-page comic that you wrote?
As part of our public and educational efforts about Dina's struggle, I had the honor of collaborating with one of the most famous comic book artists in comic history, the late Neil Adams. Neil illustrated and I wrote a comic book story about Dina's experience, which was published by Marvel Comics and helped attract additional publicity to her struggle.
An interesting story. It's too bad that it ended the way it did. Aside from teaching young people about the Holocaust, I'd like you to tell us briefly about some of the other areas of activity that are listed in your brochure, and maybe give us an example of each. For example, setting the historical record straight.
Although Professor Wyman's book, The Abandonment of the Jews, remains the gold standard in the field of research on America's response to the Holocaust, there are many areas of the American response that remain to be researched. And our scholars study and write and publish about such aspects as the American news media's coverage of the Holocaust, the responses of American Jews and various American Christian denominations, and other segments of American society and how they responded to those events. There are ongoing and very lively debates in the United States over questions related to America's response to the Holocaust. Some of these discussions take place in academic settings. Many are to be found in the letters to the editors columns or other public venues, popular publications. Because the American public remains deeply interested in the question of how we responded to Nazism and the Holocaust. The lessons of that period are not merely interesting historical footnotes, but have implications for our own time, because, of course, the Holocaust was not the last genocide. Every generation of Americans, every generation of people everywhere, are confronted with the question of how to respond when innocent people are being persecuted around the world. For Americans, the question arises every few years: should our country use its military or other power to intervene against mass persecution? So whether it was the genocide in Cambodia, or the ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, genocide in Darfur and Sudan or elsewhere, each American president has been confronted by the political question of whether to intervene. And the American public grapples with the lessons from the 30s and 40s in asking, is it our responsibility? Should we do something? Should we intervene in some way? It is the view of the David Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies that yes, everyone has a moral responsibility to care when innocent people are being oppressed and to do whatever is feasible to try to interrupt the mass slaughter. That is in our view, the chief lesson of the Holocaust years, when unfortunately almost the entire international community, including our own country and our own president, turned away from the genocide, turned a blind eye and did not do what they could have to try to at least slow down the slaughter and save some lives.
Do you think that most Americans are not aware of what the United States' position was at the time, or they have the wrong idea and they think that the United States actually did more than it really did?
In the first years after World War II and the Holocaust, very little was understood by the public about how America responded. Keep in mind that President Roosevelt was an extremely popular president, and for good reason, and he had died tragically while in office. So for many years after World War II, there was a reluctance among the public and even among historians to look at aspects of President Roosevelt's record that were less attractive, to put it charitably. However, beginning in the 1960s, historians and others for the first time began to more seriously look at President Roosevelt's response to Nazism and the Holocaust. And in the years to follow, beginning in the late 60s, but then through the 70s and the 80s, historians led by Professor David Wyman revealed a great deal of information that was at first shocking to the American public, that the president and his administration knew what the Nazis were doing to the Jews and knew early enough to have been able to have done something to interrupt the mass slaughter of the Jews had they chosen to. It took a while for this information to seep into the general public, but today the public in general is well aware that there were opportunities to rescue Jews, which our own government ignored. And there, I think there's, in general, an appreciation by most Americans that more could have been done and that was a significant moral failure on America's part.
Another activity that you mention in your brochure is stimulating public discussion, which I think is kind of related to what you were just saying. Can you give us some examples of how you do this and what kind of reactions you've gotten from the public?
One prominent example involves the well-known story of the refugee ship, the St. Louis, which in 1939 brought 930 German Jews fleeing from Hitler, brought them first to Cuba, where they were turned away, and then sailed north to the coast of Florida, where the ship waited and appealed to President Roosevelt to grant them refuge. The story of the St. Louis is probably the best-known symbol of America's response to the Holocaust, because as we know, FDR turned the ship away and was forced to sail back to Europe. An example of this story, which is not well known, is that the governor and the legislative assembly of the U.S. Virgin Islands, an American territory in the Caribbean, offered to open their doors to the refugees fleeing from Nazi Germany. So the president had at his fingertips an easy solution to give the passengers of the St. Louis temporary haven in the Virgin Islands. But we know from our research that the president was worried that if the St. Louis passengers were allowed to enter any U.S. territory, they might use that as a springboard to enter the mainland United States. And allowing any significant number of Jewish refugees into the United States was something that President Roosevelt strongly opposed. So here we have a tragic but little known example of how there was a haven that was readily available, and yet the president refused to use it. And instead, the St. Louis was forced to return to Europe, and many of those passengers were then murdered in the Holocaust just a few years later. Our research on the Virgin Islands opportunity was an area in which we pioneered a public discussion of something that was not widely known. Our findings concerning this episode have been published in various newspapers, magazines, scholarly journals. We've discussed them in public conferences and other venues so that the American public is aware. The St. Louis is not just a sad episode of how Jews wanted to come to America, but there was a tough time in America, and so there was no room for them. No, it's actually a story of how there was room for them in a U.S. territory where the doors were ready to be opened and to receive them. And yet it was President Roosevelt who made a calculated, cold decision to turn them away.
How many people do you think that you're able to reach with these public discussions or with the conferences or with the educational programs?
The main reason that we make a concerted effort to engage the wider public and not merely confine our work to the scholarly community is precisely in order to reach large numbers of Americans. By holding public programs, by writing op-eds and letters to the editor and appearing in other news media formats, we are able to reach significant numbers of Americans who are interested in these subjects. It's hard to know how many people, but if we confined ourselves to the normal academic methods, which is to only communicate with other scholars and to restrict our work to small scholarly conferences, then all of these important moral lessons would just be confined to the ivory tower, and that's not where they're needed. It's the general public that needs to know about how America responds to the Holocaust, because in the end, it's the public which elects our leaders and ultimately determines, broadly speaking, the policies of the United States in response to contemporary genocides.
Have you had much feedback from the general public?
Teachers are very appreciative of the materials we produce that can be used in classrooms. The resources involving political cartoons, animation, comic book format stories, and the like. The general public finds these subjects interesting. Our public programs tend to be extremely well attended. The programs we do online, our webinars, also attract very significant audiences. When I speak in public and I do a lot of lecturing, the Q&A sessions can sometimes go on for a really long time, and I'm perfectly happy about that. Because people have questions. People want to discuss these topics. Even though 80 years have passed, I think most Americans understand that what happened then still remains very relevant to what is happening now.
Is there anything else that you would like to add that we might have left out?
Another important issue that Americans take a great interest in is the question of why America did not bomb the railways leading to the Auschwitz death camp. We do a lot of research on this subject. There are always ongoing questions about this, because when Americans today ask whether or not the U.S. should intervene militarily against genocide around the world, the question often arises, well, what about the failure to bomb Auschwitz or the railways and bridges leading to Auschwitz? And there are many misconceptions to this day about some of the details of what happened then. But the key point about America's failure to bomb the railways to Auschwitz is that American airplanes were actually bombing the industrial section of Auschwitz in 1944, because there were oil factories there that were the Germans used for the war effort. So American planes were able to reach Auschwitz. They did actually bomb a part of Auschwitz, but they did not bomb the railways and bridges leading into the camp, and that would have interrupted the deportations. They did not try to hit the gas chambers and crematoria, which would have at least interrupted the mass murder process. So the lessons from the failure to bomb Auschwitz are extremely relevant today, because in that case, America did have the military power to interfere with mass murder, and yet it chose not to.
Well, we'll have to end it on that note. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is englishcorner@radiosephora.com. See you next week.